Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This past weekend, the Gilcrease Museum opened what may be the most unusual exhibit in this institution's history, but it's sure to pique audience interest and does touch on a collecting focus of the museum, its Mesoamerican anthropological collections. Chocolate, the exhibition, explores the relationship between Mesoamerican cultures and this treasure from the cacao tree, which the Mayans used as a frothy, spicy drink used in royal and religious ceremonies, the Aztecs, who used it for trade as a currency of sort, and finally Europeans, upon discovering it, who turned it into a worldwide commodity. My guest today is exhibit curator Gary Feinman, the MacArthur Curator of Mesoamerican, Central American, and East Asian Anthropology at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History, which organized the exhibit. Feinman, prior to coming to the Field Museum, taught for 16 years at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's authored and edited 15 books and written over 100 articles on topics ranging from world archaeology to settlement pattern research to ceramic production and shell ornament manufacture and exchange. For over 20 years, he's been conducting archaeological field research in the emergence and development of the pre-Hispanic Zapotec civilization in Oaxaca, Mexico. Chocolate, the exhibition, is on display at Gilcrease Museum through January 8th. I spoke with Dr. Feinman last week. Gary Feinman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich.
How did this exhibit come about at the Field Museum? What was the intent? Because certainly for the Gilcrease Museum, it will be a little bit of a different exhibit, although it touches on anthropology and archaeology. But really, you're talking about a commodity, really.
Yes, well, we at the museum way back about almost 20 years ago began to think about this exhibit. Jonathan Haas, who's now retired, and myself were the content specialists for it. And we felt that the journey of chocolate, the story of chocolate, was so epic and so interesting that we ought to make an exhibit for the public. We opened it in 2002 at the Field Museum, and we never imagined that it would still be on the road, you know, more than 10 years later. But it's been extremely popular, and I think that's a contribution to both the interest in chocolate, because it's so many people's favorite food. They don't really know that much about it, but its story is also fascinating.
Well, that fascinating part of the story, and it's really essentially an America's story, which Gilcrease being the Museum of the Americas, it makes perfect sense to tell this story. And it all begins with knowing where the beginnings of chocolate came from. And where did chocolate come from?
It comes from, it was first used, at least in Mesoamerica, and the tree, the Theobroma cacao, it comes from the tropical Americas. We now know that it was first consumed as a beverage probably around almost 3,000 years ago. Our earliest evidence right now is on the Pacific coast of Mesoamerica, sort of the border between Chiapas and Guatemala. And from there, it spread throughout Mesoamerica. Part of its history was that it actually was used as a currency by the Aztecs, so again, continuing its American anthropological story. And then when it went over across the Atlantic to Europe, that's when it sort of was married to sugar and to milk and eventually became the candy bar that is so familiar to us today.
Mm. Now, how was chocolate used in its very beginning, or cocoa, or What would be the first product from the cacao tree? Was it actually chocolate, or was it what we would more think of as a cocoa of some sort?
More like a hot chocolate. They would have extracted the seeds, or we call them cacao beans, but they're really seeds, from the pod. It's a very unusual tree where the branches have these pods, and you get the seeds from the pods, and you roast them and process them, and basically the material you get through that process you turn into a drink. And the most valued part of that drink that the Mesoamericans consumed was the foam. So there are actually pictures on Maya vases of people pouring the the liquid cacao from one vase to another in order to create the kind of foam that we get on the top of a glass of very special chocolate.
Do we know how the Mayans first started to actually think of using this seed from the cacao tree, how they began using it? Wasn't it like most Mesoamerican cultures, it was very much a corn society, right?
Right. It was according to later recipes, and these aren't from the earliest uses, but when we start having some written records from Mesoamerica, we know that they mixed the cacao with corn, as you say, cornmeal, also with chili, and also with honey occasionally, and flowers. So it could have a slightly sweetened taste. It was mostly bitter, but it also could sort of have a bitter, spicy taste when it was mixed with chili. So they had various recipes, and it kind of started as a local drink, but it became very much interwoven with both the ritual and ideological realm and also the economic realm in that it was used as a currency.
Now, at one point, both common and, I guess, noble, if you would, Mayans, various class, would drink this drink.
Right.
But at some point, I guess it became known outside of Mayan culture, and it had value then.
Right, definitely. And it was, we know that probably about somewhere about 2,000, 1,500 years ago, it spread very rapidly. It spread across Mesoamerica and became a strength tied in, as I said, with sort of ritual activities and probably more restricted to those of means and power. And then it spread from central Mexico up the West Coast and even spread into the southwestern United States. So it had a very broad spread by about 1000 A.D., and it was highly valued. In fact, the Aztec king Montezuma had his chocolate run up from Veracruz every day by runners, so he had fresh chocolate to consume to start the day.
So this product quickly became a trading material among many nations within the First Nations in the Western Hemisphere then.
Exactly, exactly. Archaeological studies of vases from Chaco Canyon and other sites in the Southwest show residue of the chemicals associated with cacao on the interiors. So we have pretty solid indications that it was consumed way up by the ancestral Puebloan people.
Mm. Now, in telling the story of chocolate, how did you and your colleagues conceive of this exhibition? I know there's like a full-size or life-size replicated cacao tree. How do you tell the story of this commodity in a way that's entertaining for a museum for its guest?
I think we tried to tell it as a commodity that went from the local to the global, and all the different changes that this resource underwent. I mean, today, the places that grow the most cacao barely consume it. They're in Africa. So we've gone on a journey from it being locally consumed in the tropics of Mesoamerica up to consumption in Africa, where it's barely used but shipped all over the world, and it's being integrated into the holidays. It's still important ideologically, Valentine's Day, Easter Bunny, etc. So it's been consumed and worked into the holidays of people all around the world. So I think it's a great story, and it answers so many questions that many people don't know, like where does chocolate come from, where was it first consumed, did you know it began as a drink, etc., that it was used as money. These are the questions that we try to answer in the exhibition, starting with the natural plant and its environment in parts of tropical America.
Now, once the Aztecs got into it, that's when it becomes a commodity, correct?
Yeah, then it's definitely a commodity. It's traded. It had value. It was integrated into the Aztec market system with other items having value set in cacao seeds. So it definitely was a commodity by that time, yes.
Does it become more of a drink for what I call the noble class or the upper class of Aztec society?
I think once it started to go far from where you could grow it, its use became more restricted, absolutely, and it became more associated with high status. Clearly, it had a very strong ritual connection as well.
In your work, even prior to coming to the Field Museum, you've been very much involved in sort of looking at world archaeology and anthropology, the sort of system of, you know, various regions as opposed to a particular place or a particular culture. I would think that this sort of exhibit sort of follows into a lot of what your research has been about.
It really does, and I've really enjoyed working on it and having the chance to travel the country and speak about the exhibition because it shows that societies in the past were not strictly local and closed. And that's a kind of mindset that some people have. But in actuality, even going back thousands of years, people across the world were in contact with their neighbors, traded with them, and introduced new things to them. And chocolate is very much part of that story.
Yeah. Of course, it goes to Europe when the Spanish conquered the Aztec.
Right.
What was the reception when chocolate first came to the Eastern Hemisphere?
I think they knew they had a good thing. I mean, I think if Cortez went into Mexico City and when he defeated the Aztecs, he checked in the storerooms, and some of them were piled with cacao seeds instead of gold. There were things he probably thought he would rather find. And so I think he realized that they had something delicious and special, and they brought it back to Southern Europe where it was integrated into a kind of cafe culture, again, mostly restricted to people of means who would drink the chocolate in these chocolate houses. And so even when it went to Europe, it was initially consumed as a beverage. It wasn't until a couple of centuries in Europe, and then in Northern Europe, that it began to be turned back into a solid to be consumed as a bar.
Hmm. How did that come about?
It came about as the increasing sort of what you might say commodification of this product, and it came about through a series of processes. The Europeans, when it was still consumed as a drink, were the first ones who really added sugar. So when they had these chocolate houses and they drank the chocolate, the hot chocolate, they by then preferred a sweet taste and they had access to sugar. So that was the first change. But then as it started to go into Northern Europe, people wanted to sort of make it a more of a mass commodity, and they added milk, which made it much cheaper because the milk was locally available, was not as expensive as cacao, which is limited by where the trees can grow. And, of course, they were far away. So adding milk helped make it a more distributable commodity in the 1700s and 1800s is when that process was taking place. So that's really what allowed for the candy bar, plus a number of other techniques such as molding, and it's really quite a complicated process, but there are various steps involved. The first really milk chocolate was not until 1879, but it was in 1847 in England, it was blended into a paste, which sort of made it possible to then mix it with milk.
Now, when you say talking about mixing it with milk, you're still using cacao, but you're using far less of it?
Right. Uh-huh. Milk chocolate is much lower a cacao content than dark chocolate.
And so that allows that supply to go further, because I assume they were still having to go to the New World to grow it. Yeah. At what point did it move to Africa?
I don't know the exact date, to be honest. Yeah. I think it's a fairly recent phenomenon, and when we see the large scale chocolate companies, making candy bars on a global scale. I mean, they're still growing, of course, in parts of the Americas, Brazil and in Mexico, they grow it. But the top producers in the world are now in Africa.
Now, how important did chocolate become in Europe as far as exploitation of the New World? We think of, how Europeans exploited the New World for gold, certainly coffee later, the sugar plantations and things like that. Was cocoa and cacao equally exploited by Europeans in the New World?
Yeah, it was one of the food plants that had a big impact in the history of Europe, including corn, of course, that you mentioned earlier, potatoes, which came from South America and, of course, had a great effect on the history of Ireland. But in addition, from Mesoamerica, you had cacao, corn, tomatoes, avocados, certain varieties of Chile. So all of these things were taken from the Americas and sort of reintegrated into different cuisines across the Eastern Hemisphere.
Well, I was thinking about the slave trade, certainly in sugar, in the sugar plantations in the Caribbean, that was a big reason for slavery. Was the same thing sort of happening on the continent of Mesoamerica where these cacao trees were grown?
There wasn't that much slavery per se associated with cacao, in part because the trees need to be spaced out and the density of production and the process of production is a little bit different than for sugar. Of course, sugar originally came from the Eastern Hemisphere and then was grew very well in the Caribbean, and that's what led to the sugar plantations there. But the whole process of producing sugar as a commodity is one that, I guess, was more easily integrated into a slave labor economy than was the case for cacao.
My guest today is Gary Feinman, the MacArthur Curator of Mesoamerican, Central American, and Eastern Asian Anthropology at the Field Museum of Natural History. He was one of the curators of Chocolate, the exhibition, which opened at the Field Museum, almost 14 years ago. It will be on display at Gilcrease Museum through January 8th, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, earlier you mentioned the chocolate houses. Does chocolate houses predate coffee coming to Europe?
Yes, they do.
Really? What we think of cafes in Europe were actually probably chocolate houses to begin with?
Yes, and they had their own kinds of dishes and serving vessels that were unique to the cacao beverage, the chocolate beverage, the hot chocolate. So, yes, these were very elite kinds of places, kinds of clubs where high-status people went to be seen and to use the finest kinds of porcelains.
And you have examples of those porcelains in the exhibit, too.
Yes, we do. We do. And some of the metal serving vessels as well.
And, of course, you show some of the implements used in the creation of chocolate, from the way Mesoamericans crushed the seeds to various serving vessels or recreated serving vessels, in the case of some of the Mesoamerican cultures, throughout the history of chocolate.
Yes, we do. We have, and we also have some of the advertising and pictures of people enjoying the chocolate, because of course it's enjoyed all over the world. It's been incorporated into Day of the Dead ceremonies in Mexico, and I was just on the road at an academic workshop in Maine. You don't really think of chocolate in Maine, but what did I find there? A huge chocolate mousse, not the pudding kind, but the an animal, a giant animal made all of chocolate that was on display there. So Chocolate has a resonance all over the world, and I think that's something we want to bring out in the exhibition as well.
Now, you mentioned adding a milk and milk chocolate, sort of making it more affordable. Was that the sort of tipping point along with the Industrial Revolution where all of a sudden chocolate became a luxury, the little luxury that most, you know, middle and upper class people and all people could eventually enjoy?
Yes, I think that was a critical point in the 19th century. I think another critical point was with the World Wars, when the chocolate was then packaged into the rations for the soldiers going overseas, and, you know, sort of a little treat that they could take with them. And I think that helped to spread sort of the commodified chocolate bar all over the world.
Now, the last section of the exhibit actually looks at how this is a global commodity, and you have you can see how cocoa is being traded on the futures exchange and everything in between of how this is such a big commodity, a world commodity.
Yeah, and ivory, you know, all the chocolate produced in Ivory Coast and Ghana, you know, being shipped all over the world. So it really is. It sort of has, you know, just as the way that farm prices for maize and hogs are listed every day, same thing with the cacao market. It's just grown in other places.
Now, you mentioned there's not much of a taste for chocolate in those growing areas. Is that just because it's a commodity to be sold rather than consumed?
I think so, and I think because it's had a late introduction and it's not really processed there for sale to the same degree. So only a tiny fraction of what's grown there is actually eaten. Although I wouldn't be surprised if that, you know, doesn't begin to change in the decades ahead.
My guest today is Gary Feinman, a MacArthur Curator of Mesoamerican, Central American, and East Asian Anthropology at the Field Museum of Natural History. The Field Museum was the creator of Chocolate, the exhibition, which will be on display at Gilcrease Museum through January 8th. You mentioned earlier that when this exhibit opened at the Field, all of you were surprised by its popularity. What do you attribute the popularity to this particular exhibit to?
Well, I should say also, just to flesh out what you said, we have over 2,500,000 people have come to see the exhibit in over 30 venues. And I think it's because chocolate is such a warm spot in people's hearts. It's associated with familial get-togethers and special events like Valentine's Day and Halloween. But I also think that the story is really good. I work here at the museum on the content side of exhibitions, and I really like a good story. And as soon as we started to flesh out the story of chocolate, we knew that we had something interesting for a broader public. And so it's rewarding to see that at 14 years later, it's still, you know, coming to great museums like the Gilcrease.
Now, if I can ask you in our last couple of minutes, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still doing work in Mexico. This past spring was my 40th year working in the Valley of Oaxaca, Mexico. And it's not an area where you can grow cacao at all. And yet, even in my experiences over the years in this part of the world, I've found connections to cacao. That's how important it was. One is that in one site I work on, it's still left as offerings by contemporary people when they visit the top of the hill where the site is located as a shrine for pilgrimages. And then just very recently, we found carbonized cacao seeds in a huge vessel, indicating that the beverage was handed out to people as they left a ball court at the site of Lambicheco, where we've been working over the last 4 years. So the influence of cacao in Mesoamerica was great, and it spread very widely from its original location.
Now, you've been doing research on the Zapotec civilization. Is that what the civilization you've been doing research
on? Yeah. Exactly. My focus has been at the height of the Zapotec civilization. I've been looking at why the the Monte Albán State. Monte Albán is the largest urban center in this area. It's one of the earliest urban centers in pre-Hispanic Mexico. And the amazing thing is it lasted 1,300 years. So I'm looking at the Monte Albán polity as at its height and also when it began to fall apart and trying to understand those processes.
And how far, I assume there's it's beginning somewhere down deep.
It started, as you dig down. Monte Albán was founded at 500 BC and grew very rapidly. I mean, it wasn't the biggest Mesoamerican city, but it grew very rapidly, had monumental architecture, and it really remained the regional capital until the 9th century AD. So from 500 BC till the 9th century AD, one of the longest lived capitals in almost any part of the world. Rome, of course, is a very long-lived capital as well, but there aren't that many when you think about it. So from my perspective, maybe there's something to learn from the success of this center and endurance of it over more than 1,000 years.
What happened to the Zapotecs in the 9th century?
Well, Monte Albán collapses. Fortunately, the Zapotec peoples and languages continue, but they organized themselves in a very different way so that the region at the time the Spanish arrived was composed of a number of small polities, not one larger monumental urban center dominating the region as had been the case earlier. It still was a very important area when the Spanish arrived, and Cortes actually asked for an estate in the Valley of Oaxaca. So he saw some potential there. Now, he died before he could really move in, but I think the fact that he wanted to live there suggests its importance. And the area continued to be quite important economically in the colonial period, but when synthetic dyes replaced the dyes that you got from the cochineal insect, the red dye, when that happened, the economy of Oaxaca fell off tremendously, and it's kind of been an underdeveloped or less developed part of Mexico ever since.
Well, we wish you success with that continuing research. It sounds like this is something you go back for year after year.
I definitely try. I've been doing it a long time, so I don't know how many more years are ahead of me, but I have plans to continue.
All right. Well, Dr. Feinman, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Rich, and I really enjoyed talking with you, and I hope the people of Tulsa come out and enjoy the exhibit.
Gary Feinman is the MacArthur Curator of Mesoamerican, Central American, and East Asian Anthropology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and the Curator of Chocolate, the exhibition, which is on display at Gilcrease Museum through January 8th. For more information on the exhibition, as well as several programs surrounding the exhibition, visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.